Our speaker today has chosen a subject which has been probably the most cussed and discussed subject in San Francisco for quite some time. Hippies, teeny boppers, and the asphalt Sherwood Forest. Dr. West, visiting professor at Stanford Center for Behavioral Sciences, has completed almost 20 years of study in pain, hypnosis, psychiatry, alcoholism, drug abuse, sleep disorders, hallucinations, brainwashing, racial strife, and problems of youth and adolescence. He's also touched on legal issues such as the death penalty and patterns of rebellion and violence. In these and other areas, Dr. West has published more than 60 papers, books, and monographs. A member of some 40 national, international, and regional scientific bodies, learned societies, and professional organizations, Dr. West has also served on editorial boards of several journals. During his fellowship at Stanford, Dr. West is working on a book about the Ruby case, a monograph on racial violence, and also some problems of social alienation as exemplified by the hippie subculture. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure at this time for me to present to you Dr. West to talk about the hippies.
Thank you, Mr. Ebert, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commonwealth Club of California, and guests, ladies and gentlemen. It is a great honor for me to have been invited to address this body on this topic. When the invitation came, I was reluctant to do so because I feel that there are many people in California, scholars and observers, who have been on the scene longer and could have perhaps given you a better picture. However, your representative was persuasive and persistent, and I am so grateful to California for the marvelous year that I've had here at the Center for Advanced Study at Stanford that I would have been happy to talk to you on almost any subject except the one that your speaker next week has reserved for himself. Among other things, I have been fascinated to see how society at large has reacted to what is happening in the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco. In the adult world, I'd say there are two major types of reaction. The first is one of disgust and revulsion. The hippies are seen as a pack of filthy gypsies, addicts bearing disease and bad messages, either at best an anachronism and at worst a defiance and a blot on the escutcheon of progress opposed to everything that this country and our culture would appear to stand for. The opposite point of view among the adult world seems to be one of an amused and interested tolerance, which tends to romanticize them, sees them as flower children, naive and innocent perhaps, representing an attempt to find their way to certain basic virtues, which are not so alien to our culture after all, and who, in their quaint and unusual costumes, folk lore and songfulness, have provided something of interest and even perhaps something of style. And so we have movies in psychedelic color. We have the costumes of the well-to-do being affected by the motley garb of the hippies, and I am sure that in the months to come we'll see that maybe even hair fashions will be changing and patterns of musical performance and this and that all will begin to show the effect of the hippie subculture upon style. Of more immediate concern to me, however, is a reaction, another reaction. And this is a reaction by the young. Their fascination with the hippies is in the form, among many of them, of a powerful attraction. To them, the Haight-Ashbury has represented the focus of a magical and enticing new opportunity for self-discovery, for adventure, for an escape, perhaps, from the fierce competition to which our schools and our parents and our establishment seems to force them. And so this summer, all summer long, from all over the country, although not in as large numbers as had been expected, teenagers have been pouring into the Haight-Ashbury, and many of them, sometimes called teeny boppers, have found there what they were seeking, and others have found rape, disease, rats, pneumonia, hepatitis, and disillusionment. Now, my own interest in the hippies stems from several previous areas of work. One had to do with the American character and its evolution, and the processes during adolescence whereby it evolves. A second had to do with the whole question of chemicals that affect the mind and the use and abuse of these, whether a common type of chemical like ethyl alcohol, available pretty freely to most adults, or some of the chemicals that doctors prescribe and some that people get a hold of that the doctors are unable to prescribe. I've also been interested in transactions that bring people into conflict with the law and into conflict with each other in groups. And in the Haight-Ashbury, it appeared that there was a massive experiment of nature at work to provide me with opportunities in all of these subjects, and therefore that my year in California would not be complete if I were to ignore the possibility. But it wasn't any such lofty academic and scholarly preoccupations that first took me into the Haight-Ashbury soon after I came here a year ago. It was something very specific and very personal. A runaway boy, the son of a friend, who, like increasing numbers of relatively decent, highly intelligent, middle-class and upper-class youth, had dropped out of school, made his way away from home, taken to wearing his clothes and his hair differently from the rest, and had hitchhiked to the Haight-Ashbury district and was now living there. I found him. I got him back home. And I began to find other things in the Haight-Ashbury. I attended the first human be-in there last January and found it to be an extraordinary gathering of all kinds of people. I began to realize that when one talked to the hippies, that it was not a generic term, that there are all kinds of people living in the Haight-Ashbury district, 70% of whom are Negro and have no interest in the hippie movement at all. I should perhaps say parenthetically at this point that hippies are almost 100% white, and that the Negroes in the Haight-Ashbury do not take very kindly to them at all. As one Negro leader put it in tones of unmistakable bitterness, all we want for our people is what these kids have given up. And the threat involved in that, that someone is already prepared to give up the very thing you're trying to achieve for yourself, along with the implication that they have the very unfair advantage of being able to leave the Haight-Ashbury and go back to those comfortable middle-class circumstances anywhere, has really not endeared them to the Negroes who were there before the hippies came and will probably still be there after the hippies leave. Still, the first human being was a remarkable demonstration, it seemed to me, of a searching, a seeking of people for something that obviously they were not finding somewhere else. What was it they were looking for? Peace, companionship, a sense of being close to nature, and brotherly love. People were handing out balloons with love written on them. There was one girl, obviously under the influence of some drug, but with a beatific smile on her face and a great big plastic bowl filled with little pieces of paper that she'd obviously torn up and lettered carefully herself the night before, with just the word love written on each one, handing them out as people went by. And others were giving away flowers, and still others were passing out joss sticks, incense, partly because of what they represent, good luck, and partly to cover up the universal and characteristic aroma of marijuana cigarettes, which everyone was smoking. When I realized how many runaway kids were coming to the Haight-Ashbury and how rapidly the attitudes that were being promulgated there were spreading to other parts of the country, linked to the rapidly growing use of marijuana by college and high school kids, I decided that I'd better try to find out who was looking into this a little more completely. And I finally decided that really the only way to tell what was going on in the Haight-Ashbury would be to live there oneself. Now, I wish I could say that I had turned my back upon my other commitments, my family, and so on and so forth, and gone to live in the Haight-Ashbury like a modern Baudelaire or Thoreau. But I didn't do that. For one thing, I'm too old and far too straight, they call it now. Square is what my kids used to call it, to really be accepted, although I have since found that it isn't necessary to dress up in beads and let your hair grow long to be accepted in the Haight-Ashbury. All that's necessary is to be sincerely interested and to hang around a while until they figure out that you are not a threat. But what I did, what I have done, using some funds provided for research on adolescence by the Foundation's Fund for Research in Psychiatry in New Haven, Connecticut, and under the aegis of the Oklahoma Medical Research Foundation, set up an outpost. I should tell you parenthetically, perhaps, that the University of Oklahoma Medical Center has many outposts. Our research goes beyond the borders of our state, just as is the case with California, and at this very moment, some of our people are at the South Pole studying the effects of prolonged life under conditions where there is no day and night upon sleep and dream patterns of Navy personnel. So if you're sending people to the South Pole, the Haight-Ashbury doesn't seem too far to go. But life is easier to understand at the South Pole than it is at the corner of Haight and Masonic today. Now, I have a pad in the Haight-Ashbury now. It has been occupied all summer long by a team of people, including a child psychiatrist with a special interest in adolescence, a graduate student in anthropology from Oxford, and a team of other young people, mostly college graduates, those who weren't college graduates were undergraduates, a medical student, so on, each with a different assignment. The medical student's assignment was runaways. The psychiatrist's assignment was psychotic reactions, bad trips, and other complications of the of the drug problem. The anthropologist's assignment was to discover what the social structure of the Haight-Ashbury was and who actually lives there and who the transients are and so on and so forth. And finally, we were interested in the specific phenomenon of the summer of 1967 and who the people would be that came and how they would change the Haight-Ashbury from what it had been before. Now, I can't today go into all the findings of our group. All I can tell you is that we have learned so much that we are still in the process of trying to digest it all. And the National Institute of Mental Health has given me an extension of my personal grant so I can stay out here an extra 4 months to try to wrap some of this up and also see what happens, whether the Haight-Ashbury will go back to the way it was or whether it will go on to be something else altogether. But there are a few things I can tell you, general comments about the hippies, what I think they are like, and what I think they mean. Reminding you of the premise that not all hippies are the same and that not everything in the Haight-Ashbury is hip, let me just tell you a few things about the attitudes and lifestyle of the people who actually live there and who are trying to make a certain way of life for themselves. To begin with, these are people who are profoundly independent. They want very much to be left alone. They want to be free to do those things that interest them. They are suspicious of all of the mechanisms provided by our society to make opportunities for individual self-expression available. They would rather generate their own. In fact, they're so suspicious of the plight in which the culture at large seems to have gotten itself, that they're prepared to go back to the Pleistocene and start all over again with a recreation of human culture from the ground up. They're even suspicious of the language. And in trying to express these desires, even hippies with the Ph.D. degree, there are a few, men of great intellectual and verbal ability, would not say to you that we reject the crass materialism of the American society today. We reject the fierce competition that brings people onto a treadmill that they never can get off of for a lifetime, struggling constantly to get possessions that we believe are ultimately valueless. We reject the meaning of the thermonuclear age and the atomic sword of Damocles that hangs over everybody's head and the struggles among nations for things that to us are completely unimportant. We feel that mankind is in some kind of a fit of mass insanity, that all of this really significant human values are being ignored. We insist upon a turning to concern of people for life, for the presence of man in nature, a nature that should be as uncontaminated by him as possible, and not the way your establishment is muddying the streams and destroying the purity of the atmosphere and putting chemicals into the food and water and so on. We want to live as we think human beings are intended to live, communally and with affection and brotherly love for each other. And each person should be free then to fulfill his own potentialities, to carry out his own creative impulses, and to march to the sound of his own drummer. They wouldn't say that. All they would say is, everybody ought to be able to do his own thing. And a plague on your high-blown language. The hippies are not an intellectual movement. You can go onto Telegraph Avenue and find a lot of people around there who look like hippies. They have the long hair and the old clothes and the rest. But these people are different. They are more of the new left, in a sense, or the new intellectual movement. You go into their pads, and they're full of books. There are no books in the Haight-Ashbury. You go into a pad there, and all you're likely to find is Batman comics. Now, these ideals, these aspirations, these commitments and pronouncements among the hippies are significant. They are sincere. When they get together in their town meetings, they concern themselves in a very earnest manner with questions like the plight of the cities. And one spokesman will get up and say, like, man, the cities have had it. We've got a split. Let's get out into the country where it's at, because, like, this isn't where it's happening anymore. And some spokesman for the opposite point of view will get up and say, but, man, we've got to do something for the city. We can't just let it go down the pipe. We've got to stay here and help these people. Like, we've got to show them where it's at. We've got to turn them on. We've got to teach them about love. They don't understand. You see, the hippies are concerned about us, just like we're concerned about them. Now, the mystique of the hippie movement, which, as I say, is basically religious and mystical, as it happens, is related directly and universally to a phenomenon that's quite unique to the hippies in our culture, and that is the shared drug experience. I shall not dwell upon marijuana, because marijuana is just the background music. Everybody in the Haight-Ashbury is smoking marijuana, even people who never smoked anything else. It's almost a manifestation of acceptance and a willingness to be accepted by the group. The hippies themselves do not use alcohol. They regard marijuana as a much more pleasant and benign substance, intoxication from which produces much more of a sense of well-being rather than truculence or depression, and therefore its rejection by society and its classification as a narcotic or as an undesirable substance is just another manifestation of the madness of society at large that will peddle billions of dollars worth of horrible booze all the time, with 5 million alcoholics and probably another 20 million problem drinkers in the country, and yet will forbid them from their gentle grass in which they see no harm. What the actual risks are involved in the use of marijuana and whether it should in fact be classified the way it is another topic, and one that I can't really go into today. But although marijuana predisposes these groups to a sense of brotherhood and sharing, it has been the use of the more powerful so-called mind-expanding drugs or psychedelic agents that has really been the basis for the powerful banding together of these individuals into their mystic cells or tribes, as they call them. And the most important of these substances is lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. People who have had repeated LSD experiences, especially in the company of others, not uncommonly will report a sense of having achieved an awareness of all mankind, a oneness with the universe, and with it a comprehension and acceptance of themselves and of everybody else, and a preparedness then to live at peace and under a completely different set of circumstances than they had ever been willing to live or desired to live before. So you have a drug culture, and LSD is not an innocuous substance. There are risks in it. It's not really possible to talk much to the hippies about these risks. They say, man, you think it'll change some little arrangements of RNA in my cells? What about you? What's the strontium 90 going to do to my genetic state? They feel that whatever risks they are taking lead them in a direction that's much less risky than the direction they see the rest of the world going very fast. However, and this perhaps is the tragedy of the hippie movement and the basis for the fact that already it's beginning to split up. Many of them are leaving and will not come back. It's not just to Mendocino and Laguna Beach that they have gone, or to ranches nearby in California. Some have gone as far away as Colorado, and others to Mexico, and still others to the Caribbean. And the capability of any group which bases its fundamental premise upon a drug experience has to be short-lived. The very circumstances of repeated intoxication will sap their ability to be productive, to maintain an organization, to carry forward a message, in other words, to function as a culture at all. Therefore, I'll close by putting it to you whether it isn't really a tragedy that a group of people, really drawn from all walks of life, but largely from the middle class, have been forced to turn to powerful, mind-affecting chemicals in order to discover a return to values that once upon a time in this country were considered fundamental to everybody. I'm sympathetic with what the hippies are trying to accomplish for themselves. I'm troubled by their trouble that they have encountered in achieving it. I am concerned to see what's going to happen next. But I'll say one thing about San Francisco. I think it is enormously to the credit of this community that it has been willing to accept these people on their own terms, to protect them, and to try to understand them as I've been trying to understand them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. West, for bringing an enlightening insight to another side of the hippie problem. I'm sure we'll all leave here today with a little better knowledge of what's actually going on at Haight-Ashbury. At this time, I'd like to turn the microphone back to our president, Mr. Travers, for the questions and answers.
Dr. West, if you'll be kind enough to return to the rostrum, please. We have our usual quota of questions today. The first question is this. If the price of haircuts could be reduced through congressional subsidy, do you think you could persuade the hippies to take advantage of it?
The long hair of the hippies has its significance. I think it began with the beatniks and their long hair and beards after World War II as a reaction against the GI haircut. If you had long hair and you didn't have to shave, it meant you were really out of the army at last. But among the hippies, it now means more than this. And it represents two different things among them, those who choose to wear their hair long. And I should warn you that there are some short-haired hippies who may even now have infiltrated this group and be sitting here among us. But those who wear their hair long are influenced by two different groups of people. The first are the Eastern and Oriental mystics who wear long hair and beards and are most exemplified by the image that every hippie has seen of Jesus in the picture in the family Bible. The other has to do with the American West. And in the last 3 months in the Haight-Ashbury, the costumes are changing to buckskins and Indian garb. Many of them are very interested in the American Indians, not only because of the Native American church has a mind-expanding drug as the basis for the peyote cult, but also because the Indians are noble and idealistic and live close to nature and are able to get along on very little wampum and still have a good way of life. So many of the hippies look to me like the pictures of Buffalo Bill, and others look like Chief Sequoia, and all I have to say is that I enjoyed playing cowboys and Indians when I was a kid very much.
Senator Fulbright recently said, "We have a sick society." Do you agree? And if so, are the hippies one symptom of the disease?
You know, all societies, since the beginning of social organization in man, have had their ailments. There's no such thing as a completely healthy society. And so to talk about a sick society is not to introduce a significant contribution, because all societies have their sicknesses. The question, it seems to me, about any society is whether it contains both the means and the will to treat itself constantly and move in the direction of better health. I happen to be convinced that both the means and the will exist in our society for improvement. And furthermore, I think in Western civilization as a whole, this has been the case. I really don't believe the good old days were all that good. And 100 years ago, I think that many of the values that the hippies are concerned about were much less widely accepted throughout the world than they are today. What I do think is that a society that is in a state of great flux, like ours, will cast up upon the surface in the universal and perennial rebellion of youth, it will cast up manifestations that show where the society is going and what its major problems are. All societies have been characterized by conflicts between youth and the adult establishment. This is almost never questioned. Socrates took the hemlock in 399 BC. Why was he executed? Well, for corrupting the youth of Athens. And there was no question then that the youth were corrupt. Everybody knows that the youth are corrupt. The youth are always at fault. It's only a question of who's responsible. And in that day, as in this, they looked to someone in the field of education and decided that he was the villain. So I don't think the hippies are the symptoms of a disease of society, but I think that the message of what they are trying to achieve represents part of what our society as a whole is trying to achieve, and what they have done is to find a very extraordinary way to reach that goal. And as I say, I think that their desire to reach it is great, and that their means will not succeed. And I hope that they'll keep trying and modify the means.
Doctor, a number of our members have expressed concern about the role of the press and TV in fostering the rise of the hippies. Typical of questions in this field was this one. Without the press and TV promotion of the hippies, could they continue? Are they not a product of publicity?
No, the hippies are not a product of publicity. In fact, publicity has probably changed the Haight-Ashbury from their point of view for the worse, although I do believe it has brought a good deal of valuable commerce to this fair city. Now, the press and the TV are enterprises, commercial enterprises, predicated upon the interests of the people that read them or view them. And the fact that people are fascinated with the hippies is the real basis for the fact that they've had so much publicity. It certainly isn't based upon any desire on their part for it. What they really want is to be left alone.
And for the answer to the question of how they got that way, we have this question. Count Marco says that the thing wrong with hippies is that their parents did not know how to say no. Do you agree?
Well, one wonders what these kids would have been like if their parents had said no in that case. I recently talked to a parent who came up after a lecture and said, "Doctor, what do you do with a kid that's just no good?" And I said, "Well, tell me about the kid." He said, "Well, he's 17 years old and he's been arrested a half a dozen times. He's not like my older kid, who's a very nice girl. This boy hangs around with motorcycles and a bad bunch, and he breaks the law, and he's just no good. Now, what am I supposed to do?" And I said, "Well, what have you done?" He said, "Doctor, I've done everything. I've done everything I could possibly do. I have beat the hell out of that kid every day of his life since he was 3 years old." Now, the children who are seeking something in the Haight-Ashbury are not rebelling against their parents' excessive sympathies, or are not acting this way because of a lack of self-discipline inculcated at the family hearth. It's really something quite different from that. These kids are not antisocial in the same sense that criminals are. Ask your chief of police. He has a remarkable understanding of the hippies, and his biggest job is not to arrest them for their crimes, but it's to protect them from the depredations of real criminals who would come around and take advantage of them there. I don't think it's too simple to blame everything upon the child-rearing practices of our generation and to look upon the circumstances of our children when they are trying to find themselves in terms of our failures. Psychiatry's done that a good deal, but it's just too simple. There's something else happening. Our whole society is changing, and these kids are trying to find something that in our hearts I think we'd all like to find. The question is, how can you find it? And the answer may very well lie in a consideration of the spiritual life of our society and not in child-rearing practices, economics, or anything like that.
Doctor, one of our members who has taken note of your billing in the Commonwealth as being especially concerned with brainwashing asked this question: was Romney brainwashed?
You know, if you took the word brainwashing literally, it would just be another form of mental hygiene. I think it's interesting that the word brainwashing, which is really an American journalist's translation of some Chinese ideographs that meant something, let's say a less romantic translation would have been thought reform, a process that was very successfully used by Mao Zedong in promulgating the Chinese Revolution. That this process, thought reform or brainwashing, meant something very specific. It meant small group political indoctrination, and groups of Chinese would be gathered together to review their life history with a teacher who was a communist, who would try to convince them that they should follow the way of the revolution. And it was incredibly successful among the Chinese. It was imputed to be successful against American prisoners of war, but it was not. In fact, it was a miserable failure. It turned out you couldn't brainwash the American prisoners of war very well because whether they were Negroes or whites, and a great deal of effort was spent by the Chinese to try to turn the Negroes against the whites in the Korean POW camps, just didn't work. I always thought that one reason that this indoctrination failed was that the average American has been so exposed to constant bombardments of believe this and buy that and go this way or that way or the other way all his life that he develops a high antibody titer against it. I have seen Governor Romney and heard him speak in Michigan, and I don't know what the generals did in their discourses with him, but one thing I feel very, very sure about, and that is that nobody brainwashes Governor Romney.
Trusting that the bond of friendship established between us in our brief visit at the head table here, Doctor, I'll risk today's $64 question. It is this. Is it true that most psychiatrists are their own best customers?
Now, anybody who knows anything about the medical profession knows that doctors make lousy patients. And psychiatrists are at least as difficult to take care of when they get sick as anybody else. But I think what this question must really mean is whether it isn't true that you have to be like nuts yourself in order to be a psychiatrist. And the answer to that question is that it is not necessary, although it may help.
Dr. L.J. West, we have time for but one more question. Before I ask it, on behalf of the more than 12,000 members of the Commonwealth Club of California, many of whom, as you can see, are gathered here again today at the Sheraton Palace Hotel in San Francisco for their traditional Friday luncheon meeting, I want to thank you for coming here to bring us a closer insight into the hippie revolution. At the conclusion of your answer to this last question, our meeting will stand adjourned. The question is this. What will our present hippies be 30 years from now? 50-year-old hippies or university presidents and United States senators?
I think that's a serious question, and I'm going to give it a serious answer. I think that it could go either way. And I think that whether it goes one way or another is going to depend on the use of the chemicals. If the hippies continue to require of themselves the employment of the drugs that they are using in order to find what they seek, they'll never become university presidents or United States senators or members of the Commonwealth Club of California. Their lives will become too disorganized for that. They may be benign people living on the fringes. Cranks, we'll see them, eccentrics, and failures in their attempt to bring a message of universal love and brotherhood to this society. If somehow they can discover a way, and a few, at least, among their leaders are beginning now to see the importance of this, a way to pursue these lofty goals without the necessity for intoxicating themselves in the process, then indeed it may be the case that someday we'll have a hippie university president or a hippie United States senator. And I think that such a man would be, in some ways, much better for having spent, let's say, a summer in 1967 in the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco.
This is William L. Hudson. Across the microphone from me sits Dr. L. J. West, visiting professor at the Center for Advanced Studies in Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University and chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Oklahoma Medical School, who spoke before the weekly general meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California here at the Sheraton Palace Hotel in San Francisco on the topic Hippies, Teeny Boppers, and the Asphalt Sherwood Forest. Dr. West, in your talk to the Commonwealth Club, you said you were fascinated by the way society is reacting to what has been happening in the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco. Why?
Well, I think that it's the reaction of society that indicates how important or unimportant any rebellion might be. And those things that society feels comfortable to ignore probably aren't ever going to be terribly significant to it. The hippies seem to be something that nobody can ignore, and everyone has an opinion, an attitude, a strong feeling about them. And it seems to me that in itself tells us that we ought to be paying attention to what they do and what they say.
Well, how would you classify the reaction, Dr. West, the reaction of the adults, and how does it differ from the reaction of the young?
Well, I think that our establishment tends to view the hippies either as worse than a nuisance, let's say really a menace, a bunch of dirty and probably diseased, immoral, drug-taking, free-love-practicing, semi-itinerant gypsies, and who ought to be, if not eradicated, at least kept out of town, on the one hand, or viewed with amused tolerance and a kind welcome acceptance, maybe just because they're colorful and they're different and it provides something easier to talk about than the problems of the thermonuclear age, by another segment of society which looks at the surface of the hippie life and sees the pretty colors and the flowers and the music and obvious freedom of expression there, and perhaps even secretly envies it a little bit.
Now, how about the reaction among the young?
I think among young people, the reaction is more instructive and perhaps more important, because increasingly those children who are unwilling to adhere to the pretty carefully prescribed modes of dress, of behavior, of talk, of curriculum, and everything else that is, in a sense, imposed upon them by the adult world. Those who are prepared to rebel against this will look to the hippies for a model. And when their rebellion reaches the point that they flee from those circumstances, either totally and bodily and run miles away, or secretly and partially, like the weekend teeny boppers, they come to find a message. They are seeking romance and adventure and the fulfillment of their ideals, which it seems to them the hippies seem to have an answer for.
But aren't they fleeing to a conformity, a different conformity than the one they're fleeing from?
Well, you know, a hippie once said to me, "Man, like, you know, all those people with short hair look alike to me." And I think there's a tendency on the part of the outsider to look into the Haight-Ashbury and think, well, they're all alike, so therefore there's conformity there. But these people are agreed, let's say, upon certain principles. And the most important one, the thing which is really the battle cry of the hippies, if such peaceful folk could have a battle cry, would be everybody should be free to do his own thing. And their idea of this is that you can wear what you want to and dress the way you want to and style your hair the way you want and work or not work and live where and how you choose. And the fact that so many of them choose to do it that way and in that place represents the universal phenomenon among people to demonstrate their belonging. To have long hair means to belong, and so they do it. But it's not a conformity that's imposed upon them from without.
Why did you become interested in the hippies, Dr. West?
Well, I'm interested in a field that you might call social psychiatry, the way in which our culture struggles within itself to become stronger, to become healthier, to provide individuals a greater opportunity to develop themselves, and so on. In its efforts to do this, of course, society runs onto many reefs and shoals and has to back and repair and head off in new directions. The manifestations of this struggle are always to be found in the outposts, on the periphery, on the edge where the movement is greatest. So that to me, the hippies represent a sign of change, and I'm trying to read the signs. But in addition, there are some special things about them that have been of concern to me as a psychiatrist. One is the problem of the youth, the search for identity, and the changing pattern of young people in this country today in their search for themselves. Another is the role of chemicals in our society, the use of drugs and the abuse of drugs. In many ways, the United States today is the most drug-taking collection of people ever assembled on the face of the earth. And we take pills to get going in the morning and to calm down during the day and to speed up in the evening when we're tired and to go to sleep at night. And in between, we take antihistamines and we take aspirins and we take alcohol and we take nicotine and we take caffeine and we pour into ourselves all kinds of chemicals that affect the nervous system of the human body. Now, here are people who are using chemicals, marijuana and LSD, for example, as a means to a different kind of an end. This drug use by them actually represents a sacrament, you might say, although I think that they tend to play that up more than it deserves. It's a means to a spiritual end. How do you find a brotherhood? How do you find universal understanding and a sense of oneness with your fellow man? Why, you turn on with him. You take a trip with him. You get high with him. You get stoned with him. And then that makes you brothers. And without this ceremony, they don't believe it can happen. I believe it can happen without the ceremony, but I think that until the hippies learn that it can, we are going to see, as we are seeing, a remarkable collection of individuals whose lives and culture is based upon the use of illegal chemicals. And that brings them into conflict with the law and with society as a whole and sets into action, you might say, a whole new set of circumstances then.
Doctor, are there many Negroes among the hippies in the Haight-Ashbury district?
No, there are almost none. Although the Haight-Ashbury is 70% Negro, there are virtually no Negroes who have joined the hippies in the usual sense of the term. There are many Negro boys who hang around the hippies because this is one place in which their overtures to white girls might be more acceptable than in the rest of our culture, and the juice of the forbidden fruit is always sweet. But the fact of the matter is that the rebellious Negro youth today is striving to acquire those things that the American middle class has already obtained for itself, and they are rebelling against their parents, who were a relatively peaceful, religious, and accepting group of people who were willing to live under conditions of poverty and deprivation and still try to make a happy life for themselves by greater concern, let's say, for spiritual values than for material ones. The Negro kids are turning against this in their parents and moving in the direction of the middle class, whereas the hippies are going in exactly the opposite direction. They come from the white middle class. They've had all these things available to them in their backgrounds, and they could have them now if they chose. And instead they choose to go into a slum and to live there on the edge of poverty and to seek out values that have nothing to do with material possessions at all. So you can see how it might be that the rebels, these two different groups of rebels, carooming past each other in search of something, each something different, are, although they live in proximity, have very little in common.
Dr. West, would you say that the hippies of the Haight-Ashbury district are different or substantially the same as the hippie manifestation they have in my town of Berkeley?
Well, there are some real hippies in Berkeley, but there are many, that is, by real hippies, I mean of the Haight-Ashbury type. But there are many young people who look like hippies to the untrained eye. Their hair is long and their clothes are strange and they go barefoot in the street, who are not involved in this mystical search for brotherhood at all. Instead, they belong to what I would call the New Left, and they represent an intellectual and political avant-garde, a rebellion against those things in our national structure that they regard as unfair or as imperialistic, if you will, and which they are striving to change, actively to change by their own efforts.
But the hippies in Haight-Ashbury, most of them are not intellectual.
They, even though they may have been once, in the process of becoming mystical, they have turned their back upon intellectual solutions and instead are more concerned with existential solutions, if you will, or solutions that have to do with living your beliefs rather than writing them down in manifestos or haranguing people on street corners about them.
Well, Dr. West, do you think that the hippie movement is going to last?
I don't think it will endure very long in its present form, because I don't believe that a culture which leans so heavily upon the use of chemicals can continue in any form. The ability to maintain organization, to preserve a cultural form, is dependent at least in part upon faculties that the use of these drugs tend to impair. However, the last people in the world to want to preserve anything are the hippies themselves. They make no claim, even to the name of hippies. And in fact, recently I heard a reporter say to a group of hippies that were grumbling about the way the press and the world treats them as a lump and calls them hippies. The reporter said, "Well, why don't you want to be called hippies? A perfectly good name. What would you rather be called?" And one bearded gentleman stood up, and in a sonorous voice he said, "People."
Thank you very much, Dr. L.J. West, visiting professor at the Center for Advanced Studies in Behavioral Sciences, Stanford University, and chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Oklahoma Medical School, who spoke before the Commonwealth Club today on hippies, teeny boppers, and the asphalt Sherwood Forest.